This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, after a lot of loss in the last couple of years, an expert on grief joins the show with some reassurance and advice. We'll meet the author of the new book, The Myth of Closure. Now, President Biden is heading to Brussels next week for a NATO summit on Russia's war with Ukraine. The meeting comes at an important time for the military alliance as it tries to figure out how big a role to play in the conflict, and as President Biden has warned against Russia attacking NATO countries.
As I made crystal clear, the United States will defend every inch of NATO territory with the full force of American power. And the good news is, NATO is more united and more determined than ever.
We're taking a closer look at the NATO alliance, how it works, its past, present, and future, and its role in responding to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you glad the U.S. is still part of NATO? Do you think it's a good thing to have an alliance like this that could counter countries like Russia? Or do you think its time has passed with the end of the Cold War? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sean Monahan is a visiting fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He focuses on European security and defense. We're talking to him in that capacity today. He also works for the UK Ministry of Defense, where he focuses on international defense policy, including NATO. Sean, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Good afternoon. It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I want to listen to a little more of President Biden. This was an address to the nation after Russia invaded Ukraine last month.
There is no doubt that the United States and every NATO ally will meet our Article 5 commitments, which says an attack on one is an attack on all.
That's one of the core ideas of the NATO alliance. Can you talk about that commitment and the wider role of NATO?
Absolutely, Rob. So, as you say, and as President Biden alluded to, the most important aspect of NATO, so NATO is a political military alliance of 30 nations, mostly in Europe, but also the US and Canada, focused on security in Europe and the Atlantic region. NATO was formed in 1949 in the Washington Treaty, and the most important fact about NATO is indeed this Article 5 provision. And that is, if you like, the Three Musketeers clause, the all for one and one for all. So what it means, Rob, is that an attack on any member of NATO would be considered as an attack on the whole alliance, and the whole military weight of the alliance would be brought to bear on the aggressor.
As you mentioned, 1949 was the year this started. The threat I think everybody had in mind then was the Soviet Union and then its allies or satellite regimes in the Warsaw Pact. That's over. What is NATO's role in a post-Cold War world?
Yeah, it's a good question. I guess a lot of people thought or at least hoped that we'd seen the end of NATO, because NATO was created, as you suggest, to counter aggression from the Soviet Union, now Russia. And after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Cold War, many folks thought that, you know, NATO's days were numbered. And in fact, this would actually be quite a good thing, because it would represent NATO, you know, would not be needed anymore. Fast forward 30 years, Russia has invaded its neighbor Ukraine, and it's become all too clear to all of us watching on our screens the horrific scenes that are unfolding in Ukraine that NATO really is more necessary than ever to protect its members from Russia, which under President Putin is clearly unafraid to use military power to subjugate other nations in a way that we really have not seen on this scale, I'm afraid, since the Second World War.
Now, Putin has cited NATO expansion eastward as one of his grievances that led, among other things, to this invasion of Ukraine. The invasion of Ukraine, though, has given Putin's non-NATO neighbors maybe a real incentive to join NATO. Can you talk about that tension over, are we provoking a leader like Putin by expanding NATO versus providing needed protection to neighbors given his aggression?
Yeah, absolutely. So Indeed, Mr. Putin has made a number of arguments, some of them fairly incoherent. One of them being, indeed, that NATO presents a threat to Russia. I suppose I would look at it the other way round. So NATO, since the end of the Cold War, has expanded by a number of nations. So those ex-Soviet Union countries that you referred to and ex-Warsaw Pact countries, mm-hmm. most of them have now joined NATO. They have taken an independent democratic decision and they have amended their constitutions to join NATO based on the public opinion in those democratic nations. So they have decided to do that. The reason they have decided is because they have a neighbor who has appeared over the years to be revisionist and aggressive. And, those nations that have joined in the past 20 years are probably quite glad that they have done so, because we now see that this exactly turns out to be the case, that Russia under Mr. Putin is unafraid to use military power to invade and use overwhelming force against civilians in a completely illegal and unjustified and unprovoked manner. So they are justified in joining NATO. You mentioned Ukraine. Ukraine did have a path to membership in NATO. In 2008, in Bucharest, a treaty was signed, or a memorandum, an agreement that both Ukraine and Georgia would be put on a path towards NATO membership. Now, they weren't very close to becoming members. And let me just briefly explain why. Mm-hmm. To become a NATO member requires satisfying a number of criteria, both about the democratic institutions within the country, so NATO is an alliance of democracies, and also about the state of the military forces of the nation. So NATO is an alliance of advanced military forces. So Ukraine had not met those targets yet, but was undertaking a process to meet those targets. By all accounts, it wasn't very close. This was a number of years off. So, to use the excuse that Ukraine was just about to join NATO is just factually incorrect.
We're talking about NATO, the U.S. role in it, and NATO's role in responding to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Sean Monahan is with us from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about NATO, with your thoughts on what you want to see the U.S. and NATO allies do in response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, or not do. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Sean, there's been, I think, two lines of criticism of NATO and its response to the invasion, that it's doing too little or too much. Let's start with the too much, the idea that Ukraine is not a member of NATO. It's not subject to the Article 5 clause requiring this defense. By providing a lot of arms to Ukraine, NATO could be ratcheting up tensions with Russia even more. What do you say, first of all, to that line of concern?
Yeah, well, NATO nations, and let's remember, by the way, NATO is an alliance of democratic nations. So it's not too much on its own. It's a set of offices in Brussels, really. NATO represents the views and the military capabilities of those 30 nations. So it's really up to those nations to decide what they want to do and how they want to help or not in the situation. I think people say, well, why isn't NATO doing this? Again, NATO is a collection of democratic nations. So what NATO does and doesn't do ultimately comes down to public opinion. On the doing too much angle, so NATO nations have quite a fine line. They're walking a bit of a tightrope in that they clearly want to do, they have a moral compunction to do as much as possible to help the people of Ukraine cope with this terrible situation that they find themselves in. But at the same time, if NATO does too much and gets too directly involved, there is always the risk of what is a dreadful war in Ukraine becoming a much larger conflict. So that's the fine line that NATO nations are treading in their response.
I wanted to ask you about one specific element of accusations that NATO countries aren't doing enough, the idea of a no-fly zone. Ukrainian President Zelensky made the case for that repeatedly, including to the U.S. Congress. Why would NATO countries be reluctant to impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine?
Yeah, so the Ukrainians have asked for this repeatedly. And this is something we've done as a NATO alliance and other coalitions in a number of conflicts, from over the skies of Iraq, and over the skies of the Balkans as well in the 90s, and since in Libya as well, I believe. So we can do this. The difference is between those conflicts, those civil wars, and the situation in front of us is that a no-fly zone, Rob, would require NATO forces to be willing to shoot Russian planes out of the sky, and also to destroy Russian air defenses, which may be based in Russia itself. So to enforce the no-fly zone, they would have to do that. Now, NATO forces are technically capable of doing this, but doing so increases the risk of escalation, the risk that in response, Russia, rather than Mr. Putin, would then respond in kind. And, you know, war is inherently unpredictable. And once you enter a cycle of conflict like that, you really don't know where it's going to go. So NATO has an imperative, and this is the argument against the no-fly zone, to minimize the chances of further escalation, again, while helping Ukraine to do as much as it can. And we saw President Biden announce a huge package of military assistance to Ukraine yesterday. And that's the kind of aid that Ukraine needs. In the words of the UK Defense Secretary, the best kind of no-fly zone is perhaps one that Ukraine can provide itself through air defense and other weaponry.
We're talking to Sean Monahan, expert on European security and defense with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's with us today to talk about how NATO works and the position it's in during Russia's invasion of Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you glad NATO is still around, that the U.S. is still part of it? Do you think NATO countries, other ones, need to spend more on defense? What do you want to see NATO countries, including the U.S. and its allies, do when it comes to the Russian invasion of Ukraine? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about NATO with Sean Monahan from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions about the NATO alliance, the U.S. role in it, and its role in the Russian invasion of Ukraine, its response there. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Saeed joins us now in Green Bay. Saeed, hello.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. I am struck by the inconsistency in American foreign policy right now. If we are supporting the people of Ukraine, not because they're members of NATO, but because they are a people who are trying to defend their rights for democracy and self-determination, simultaneously with that, we are carrying out a negotiation with Iran. We're about to sign another agreement with the despotic regime in Iran that suppresses its own people, that has the blood of its own people on its hands. So we are going to empower them and negate the aspirations of Iranians for the very same things that the people of Ukraine want. Yet in one forum, we are sending arms and risking confrontation with a nuclear power. And on the other, we are recklessly disregarding the aspirations of Iranians for rights.
Saeed, thanks for that call. Sean, do you see those things at odds with each other?
the world of international politics is very complicated. I'm no expert on Iran and on the process to stop Iran getting developing nuclear weapons. There are several arguments as to the best way to do that. I think what I would say is the situation in front of us in Ukraine appears to be fairly simple. You have a large, powerful country with nuclear weapons, Russia, simply invading, subjugating, and bombing on a daily basis hundreds, if not thousands now, innocent civilians. And we have to decide whether that's the kind of behavior that we want to see in the world, and that we want the rules and the international order that we live in, if we want to accommodate that kind of behavior. So that's the kind of black and white problem in front of us in Ukraine. It's not an easy one. We were just discussing, the difficulties with deciding what military action to take. But the world is clearly united against Mr. Putin. The level of economic sanctions is absolutely historical and is having clearly a huge effect on the Russian economy. So we hope that has an effect on Mr. Putin's decision making.
Thanks for the call, Saeed. We'll go to Nate now in Sauk City. Nate, hello.
Thank you. Thanks for taking the call. I didn't hear all of the details of my predecessor's call, so I may be a little redundant. But I do want to say I believe the NATO and the U.S. need to be more robust, particularly in the I believe that the line between where we are currently and World War III is a little more gray than maybe the administration publicly portrays it. I don't know what they're doing but behind the scene, but I definitely feel very strongly that we cannot allow the Russians to gain a military advantage here in the Ukraine.
Nate, thanks a lot for the call. As Sean, Nate sees a wider gray area between where we are now with support of Ukraine and the risk of touching off World War III, but it's a line you don't necessarily want to cross, right?
Exactly, Rob, exactly. It's the sheer unpredictability, and the leaders of the US and NATO just don't want to cross that Rubicon and kind of lose control of the situation. They have a strategy at the minute which could hopefully produce the goods, and that's Mr. Putin changing his mind and backing down, however unlikely that seems at the minute. The strategy of supporting Ukraine has put up an absolute fearsome resistance. It stopped the might of the Russian army in its tracks, and if we continue to help them do that whilst piling on the pressure economically, whilst isolating Russia diplomatically, then the strategy is that this will force Mr. Putin into changing his behavior.
Nate, thanks for the call. Joy joins us now in West Bend. Joy, hello.
Hi, thanks. I want to say that I would like all countries to respond by refusing to add to the arms, to add to the violence, to participate at all in violence. NATO is inherently really an offensive organization. If they're set up to say who's our allies and who are our enemies. We have United States has military installations in every corner of the world. So I'm not saying that Putin is doing something great. I think that nobody should have war anymore. As long as we have nuclear weapons, and even conventional weapons are so destructive, it's time to say, let's really use the UN. Let's not try to make allies and enemies.
Thanks for the call. We don't have too much time left, but Sean, I've seen calls to focus on the UN to do some of the things that NATO does. In the case of Russia has basically a veto vote on the Security Council.
Yeah, that's right. Russia's one of the permanent five members that can veto UN initiatives. But nonetheless, the UN has been doing a lot. Mm-hmm. And there was a historic vote in the General Assembly last week where an overwhelming number of countries voted to condemn what Russia and Mr. Putin are doing. And, you know, that shows that the weight of world opinion is totally against what's going on here. And that's really important still.
Thanks for that call, Joy. In our last minute or so, Sean, what are you watching for next from NATO in its response to this, now where we're kicking off the fourth week of this invasion?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yesterday NATO had a summit of defense ministers. And so next week's summit, President Biden is going over to Brussels. It'll be a leaders summit, an extraordinary leaders summit. I think the NATO summit yesterday with defense ministers, we can see some more of the same. So NATO essentially officially said, need to go back to the drawing board here. We need to reset our approach to defense and deterrence in Europe. And if you look at what some of the NATO members are doing, look at Germany, for instance, it's completely rewritten its foreign policy almost overnight. It's now providing lethal aid to Ukraine. It's looking at spending another 100 billion euros on defense. And that pattern is continued. Even Finland and Sweden now are thinking about joining NATO. So this is really a huge, you know, the tectonic plates of kind of European security are shifting. And NATO is at the foundation of that. So I think NATO just needs to look again at what it can do to provide to continue to be the most successful military alliance, you know, the world has ever seen, really, and provide security and stability in Europe. But it's clearly got a lot of work to do in the coming weeks and months. Rob,
Sean, thanks again for joining us today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
That's Sean Monahan. He's an expert on European security and defense with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He was with us today for a conversation about NATO and what Russia's war in Ukraine means for the future of the military alliance. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, supervised drug use sites are seen as one tool in the effort to stop things like overdose deaths and the spread of disease through drug use. But not everyone loves the idea. Kate and her guests tell us how those programs work and the kind of impact they can have and how widely they're being used or not used so far. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Do you have a secret ingredient that you like to use in your cooking? Even if it's not really a secret, is there something you turn to when you need a little extra something in your food? If so, we want to hear about it. On tomorrow's edition of Food Friday, we'll talk to the author of the Secret Ingredient Cookbook about the little things that can bring a recipe to a new level. If you have one to share that we can maybe even share on the air, let us know right now. Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime, all one word, @wpr.org. Or tweet us @centraltimewpr. Examples, I have a few. I've mentioned on the show before, red wine vinegar shows up a lot. More and more lately, I've been using lemon in more and more stuff right at the end of the cooking process. And cilantro. Like, I've known about fresh cilantro for a long time, but thanks to past Food Fridays, I've gone from using a little bit to a fistful of cilantro and a few cilantros more. What's yours? Again, email centraltime@wpr.org or tweet us @centraltimewpr and join Food Friday tomorrow for more inspiration. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, with COVID restrictions being widely lifted, Jen White asks, how do we respect the needs of the estimated 7 million Americans who are immunocompromised? That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, whether you lost a loved one, a job, or a pivotal milestone like your graduation ceremony, just about everyone has been affected by COVID-19. And grieving those losses isn't a simple process. We may try to get over it, to get back to normal, to find closure. But our next guest says closure is a myth. And as tempting as it may be to try to forget the things we missed, our guest today says we should instead live with and embrace those losses. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you dealt with a loss during the pandemic? Are you willing to share that story? Do you know someone else who lost a loved one? Do you feel like you're able to get over the challenges you faced? How have you made a new life after that loss? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Pauline Boss is Professor Emeritus of Family Social Science at the University of Minnesota. Her latest book is The Myth of Closure, Ambiguous Loss in a Time of Pandemic and Change. She's also from Wisconsin and a UW-Madison graduate. Pauline, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
I want to start with this core idea. I think there's this idea out there in our culture that after a loss, you know, a loss of a loved one, maybe the goal is to find closure, to get back to normal. And if we don't get there, we're doing it wrong. Talk about why, please, that's a myth.
It's a myth because it's not possible once you've had a relationship with someone, once you've loved someone, that when they're gone, it's not possible to close the door on them. Most people remember them, keep them in their hearts and mind, do things in their honor, and tell stories about them and so on. So the normal way is to remember the person who is gone from death, for example, instead of closing the door. And even if you look back at the sages who taught us, from Freud to Kubler-Ross, in their personal writings, they also indicate that they didn't have closure on their own personal losses, even though in their professional writings, they seem to tell us that detachment was the thing, at least Freud did, and Kubler-Ross essentially had presented the five stages, which were deeply misunderstood. In general, we want meaning instead of closure. We want certainty of where our loved ones are buried, of whether or not they're dead or alive, and that means with ambiguous loss, you're never sure if the person you care about is going to come back or not, as they used to be. And that can be a case of soldiers missing in action or kidnapped children. That's physical ambiguous loss. Or it can be psychological ambiguous loss, is when someone is sitting right in front of you. They're present, but they don't know who you are. So there are different kinds of losses. One is one with certainty. That is when there's a death certificate. And the other is when they're missing. In mind or body, and that's an ambiguous loss. In either case, there is no closure.
You include the phrase ambiguous loss in the title of your book, and with COVID, it seems like that added a whole new category that you talk about a lot in the book, where a person may have passed away because of COVID or something else, maybe in a hospital setting, and you couldn't be with them, and the opportunities to mark their passing in the way we usually would with a funeral or something like that was taken away from so many people. Did that add to this challenge of ambiguous loss?
Yes. Now, not being able to have a funeral, the ritual of a funeral, is a psychological ambiguous loss, but it also has a physical component because the gathering of friends and family is usually a comfort to the person who is mourning, and that couldn't be done. But there were other losses, many, many losses during the pandemic. And I think part of our anxiety has been the result of the uncertainty about, are we safe? Can we trust the world we live in to protect us? And can we trust the people sitting next to us on a bus as to whether or not they might pass the virus? So these are all ambiguous losses. And then, of course, there were many clear-cut losses, many quantifiable losses, such as loss of income, loss of a job, and things like that. So during this pandemic, during this difficult 2 years or more, people have had many losses, and I think they're not aware of it, which would normalize then the feelings of anxiety that they have. I think that feeling anxious in the past 2 years was a normal reaction to an abnormal situation.
I think a lot of people during the pandemic have had that sense like, okay, yes, things are bad now, but we're going to get back to normal. It's going to be over in the rearview mirror, and then we'll get back to normal life. And that, in many ways, keeps receding and getting pulled away from us. How do we create a normal life in a time of ongoing uncertainty like that?
I write about both and thinking in the book. The best way to cope with this kind of stress that we're having now, and I think still for a little while longer, although I hope it's receding, and that is by thinking both and. You know, I both think this is terrible and I can manage it. I both am restricted in what I can do, and I can learn some new things meantime. I both am restricted from going to concerts and large-scale gatherings, and I can still have contact with friends in sidewalk cafes. So this both-and thinking is the way to reduce stress during a time of great pressure from the outside, when something else is controlling your life, like a virus, like a war, those kinds of things. Then you need to find something smaller that you can control in your life. So I think we all can do that. And I believe that's why during the height of the pandemic, many people were baking bread, because you could control that for a couple hours. You knew what you were doing. You controlled the outcome. You enjoyed the outcome. And those kinds of things are very good coping mechanisms for when the outside context of your life is in chaos.
We're talking to Pauline Boss about her new book, The Myth of Closure, Ambiguous Loss in a Time of Pandemic and Change. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you'd be willing to share a story of a loss in your life, a loved one maybe, or loss of normal life in one way or another. How you've worked with that. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Yordis is with us in Colfax. Yordis, hi.
Hi. I have had a terrible time with grief. We lost two kitties during COVID, and one to cancer and one to a brain tumor. And I just collapsed. I couldn't stop shaking. I've never had medication to control any kind of emotional thing like that. And I actually needed to have medication at an emergency room because my husband was terrified. And it was, you know, I've read three books about grief. And see, the first cat, it was sudden. His cancer was rapidly growing, and he passed very suddenly when we took him in. It was severe. It was, you know, he had to be euthanized. And the second cat, he was getting sick, and then he would get better, and then he was getting sick, but he never quite got all the way better. And it took a long time, probably 6 months of nursing, you know, taking him to the vet, figuring it out, helping him. And when he passed, the vet figured that he was, the brain tumor, when it was growing, was causing the symptoms, and then when it stopped growing, he would seem to get better. And so it was, you combine that with COVID, which has made me terribly anxious, and then the former president, that was just fear all the time.
Yordis, thank you for the call, and I'm sorry you went through that. Pauline, with a series of losses like that, how do we start to try to get out of that, the darkest part of that?
Yeah, I'm very sorry for such losses. And what she really described was a pileup of losses.
Right.
And we call that stress pileup also. What it does after a while, especially if you have so much piled on top of one another, it makes us feel helpless. And helplessness is not a good thing for a human being. And so you probably need to see somebody for help with learning how to cope with these helpless feelings. But meanwhile, what I write about is mastery. We are a nation of people at least in Western culture, who like to master situations. We like to master problems and find cures for the things we love, for our pets and our people that we love. We like to master and fix things. And when we can't, we feel helpless. And so I think it's useful for you to think about this as something that you did the best you could, but you couldn't fix it. The same with the pandemic, the same with politics, and unfortunately the same with your two kitties. And so sometimes we fail, and we have to allow ourselves that possibility that we work hard, we do the best we can, and we still can't solve the problem. The pandemic has taught us something. It was an invisible enemy out there around us, very dangerous and deadly. And at first, we could not control it at all, at least not until the scientists came up with vaccine. You still have to find something you can control in your life. For example, putting on a mask, getting a vaccine were very helpful things to control. And what you did by going to the vet and doing the best you could, you too did the best you could to control. And now and then, we still have a loss because of that. Don't blame yourself. Many times, the blame is on an illness. The blame is in the context. Externalize the blame. Don't take it on your own shoulders. That's too much.
Yordis, thanks for being willing to share that with us. Pauline Boss is with us, Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota, author of the book we're talking about, The Myth of Closure, Ambiguous Loss in a Time of Pandemic and Change. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you or someone you know lose a loved one during COVID? What strategies are you using to try to process that loss? Does it ever get easier? Do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Pauline Boss about her new book, The Myth of Closure, Ambiguous Loss in a Time of Pandemic and Change. Before I go back to our callers, Pauline, you apply some of your ideas about grief and loss to racial trauma and racial injustice in the United States as you were writing this, not just COVID, but the murder of George Floyd in your city of Minneapolis. How do you apply your thinking to this vast historical situation?
Well, I began at the University of Wisconsin in Madison studying ambiguous loss on a family basis. As I said, the wives of soldiers missing in action, and then the families of loved ones who had Alzheimer's disease. What I'm realizing now, that it can also be on a community and a national and a global level. It can be the larger family, if you will, the family of the community. And what I noticed during the George Floyd killing, that there has been injustice amongst the black families for so many, I would say, centuries, hundreds of years since slavery, when the families were sold apart from one another on auction blocks. And that trauma of ambiguous loss, of not knowing where your children were or not knowing where your parents were or your mate, that trauma has been passed down through the generations. And there has been no acknowledgement of it. You can't cope with something until it has a name, until you know what it is. And I think the ambiguous loss of what happened to the families of the slaves way back when is still with us today, and we need to face it. We need to acknowledge also the genocide of the Native Americans and all the other kinds of separations of families that we have done. We can't just bury it. And those that happen in our neighborhood, we have to face them. And what is called for is major change, major systemic change in how we interact as a community, as a human family.
Let's go back to our callers now. Emily is with us in Green Bay. Emily, hello.
Hi there. I was just wondering if you guys could touch on how the COVID pandemic affected people's mental health. My close friend completed suicide because they felt so lonely and didn't have anyone to talk to during these times. Do you have any information or resources you're able to provide?
Emily, I'm sorry. Thank you for calling in. I'm sorry for the loss of your friend. Pauline, the loss of connection there was a key element, it sounds like, for Emily's friend. How do we make sure we stay connected even in a tough time?
Yes, I'm so sorry about that loss. It was very difficult during this long period of COVID to stay connected with friends. And many of us learned to use technology to do that for the first time, Zoom and so on. But still, there were many people who didn't have broadband and many people who didn't know how to use the technology or didn't have computers. And what I find with the younger people is that they like to text, and older people don't because they want to use their voices and talk on the phone. So that sometimes older people didn't talk with anyone for weeks at a time. So you had to sort of figure out another way to stay connected. In my apartment building, for example, some younger people down the hall, they would go to the farmers market, but I wouldn't because I'm 87 and I was high risk. I would find a bunch of vegetables in a bag on my door. Now, they didn't talk to me, but that was a lovely piece of communication by having vegetables dropped at my door. And so I knew that someone cared nearby. But I hope this, that now that things are easing up a bit, that we have neighborhood groups, that you have friendship groups, that you have book groups, that you have athletic groups, walking groups, because we are social animals and we need to talk with each other. And it's very important for you now to go out and have some two or three other people that you like to spend time with, like-minded people, that you can be with several times a week. It's time to be social again. It's necessary for human health.
Thanks again for calling in, Emily. Mark joins us now in Greenville. Mark, hi.
Hi there. All right, so my question is sort of about, so we've had this heightened anxiety from the pandemic, and I'm sort of questioning why sometimes, like, past experiences of trauma all of a sudden are brought up because of other incidents happening now.
Mark, thanks for that call. That makes sense. I think in some ways we're in a tough time, and maybe something from years ago rears up again, Pauline.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The caller was very wise about that. And what happens is, if we've had trauma early in our life and we haven't dealt with it, we haven't had help with it, even if we were children, it's still with us. And then maybe a decade or two later, along comes another event, and that will bring back the echo of that first trauma. So I think we need to talk about our experiences early on, all the losses we have had, the clear losses, the ambiguous losses, the ones you can't put your finger on. Find somebody to talk to, a peer, a grief group, a recreational group, or a therapist, because it's very important to deal with the traumas we've had early in life, because they will rear their ugly head again when we have a current trauma like we've had now.
Mark, thanks for that call. We just have a minute left. Pauline, you're very helpful about how we can tap into our resilience. Can you leave us just in a minute with your thoughts on that?
Well, I think we're more resilient than we think. And you should check your own experience these past 2 years. Haven't you learned something new? And you're still, if you're still standing, you should pat yourself on the back for getting through a worldwide pandemic, and for learning something, and for, I hope, being stronger for the experience that you've had. Suffering actually can make us stronger. At least you need to know that you've learned something from it, and that you are stronger than you think. And so are your neighbors. And so the empathy for them and the empathy for yourself is very important once we're coming out of this tough time.
Pauline, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
You're welcome.
Pauline Boss is the author of the new book, The Myth of Closure, Ambiguous Loss in a Time of Pandemic and Change. You can find a link to her book and more info at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, if you're like me, you might fall into a rut when you're cooking for the family. Food Friday is coming to the rescue with the author of the Secret Ingredient Cookbook. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, mask requirements are ending around the country. We'll talk to a Wisconsin doctor about precautions that we might still want to take. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.